content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today we're reading from the December 22nd, 2023 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week is a supermarket scene. Actually, it could be a Walmart or something like that. There are eight or nine folks with shopping carts lined up along the aisle, various things in their baskets. But instead of faces, they all have the frowny face emoji in its place. The headline is, "Not Feeling It: Why a Booming Economy is Failing to Lift America's Mood." That is one of our talking point stories. And we'll start with the main stories. The headline for the first main story is House GOP Votes to Advance Impeachment Inquiry. But as I did last week, I'm going to read the two shorter main stories. Zelensky's aid appeal falls flat in deadlocked Congress. What happened? Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky made a hastily arranged visit to the White House and Capitol Hill this week, pleading for additional U.S. aid for a Ukrainian military running desperately low on artillery shells and air defense munitions. The aid bill, though, remains stalled in Congress, with Republicans continuing to demand that funding for Ukraine be tied to substantial concessions to GOP priorities for the southern border, including the resumption of family detentions and new limits on political asylum. The Senate continued working on its version, a $110 billion package that includes border funding and aid to Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan, but Minority Leader Mitch McConnell said a deal before the end of the year was practically impossible. House Speaker Mike Johnson indicated he wouldn't even keep the House in session past this week, saying, "I'm not going to have everybody sit here through Christmas twiddling their thumbs." Russia is banking on the United States failing to deliver for Ukraine, President Biden said, with Zelensky at his side. Ukraine's situation is precarious. Despite receiving $75 billion from the U.S. to date, it has failed to claw back very much territory. Russia continues to occupy about 20% of the country and has announced plans to nearly double its own military spending. Still, the counteroffensive has taken a toll. A newly declassified U.S. intelligence assessment says that some 315,000 Russian soldiers have been killed or injured, about 87% of Russia's pre-war force. What the columnist said: "An unspeakable outcome is suddenly possible," said Lee Hockstetter in the Washington Post. "Kyiv is at risk of losing. Russian President Vladimir Putin has two advantages: indifference to Russia's staggering casualties and strategic patience in the gamble that Western support for Ukraine will crumble. Without additional aid, Ukraine could soon run out of vital weapons, forcing its troops to fall back, shorten their defensive lines, and abandon territory. It is obscene that Republicans are holding up military aid to an ally that is engaged in a shooting war," said Jonathan V. Last in the Bulwark. "But my advice to Biden? Cave on immigration. Ukraine is the more urgent priority, and by accepting the GOP's demands, Democrats would make Republicans equally culpable for the border crisis. For Republicans, immigration is like abortion. It's not an issue they want to solve. It's a political club they want to wield. Call their bluff. Ukraine is a brave nation willing to fight and die in a battle against the U.S. foe," said Jackie Combs in the Los Angeles Times. "It asks only that we provide aid and that aid helps American workers, too. 60% of Ukraine funding has gone to U.S. factories that produce military equipment. If Ukraine surrenders and embolden Putin, could well set his sights on NATO territory, which the U.S. is treaty-bound to defend. Compared with sending American troops into combat, military aid is a bargain. Biden criticized Israel as Gaza death toll mounts. What happened? President Biden this week warned Israel that it risks losing international support for its war on Hamas through the indiscriminate bombing of Gaza, revealing a growing split between the Biden administration and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. As close to half of Gaza's population of 2.2 million threatened to crowd into Rafah on the Egyptian border, hunger and disease, including hepatitis and rabies, spread through Gaza. Prices of food surged and rent for rooms in Rafah went up 50-fold as families tried to shelter under thin plastic sheets. With Gaza's death toll rising to 17,700, according to the Hamas-controlled health ministry, Israel continued a campaign of bombardment and expanded its operations with giant pumps that use seawater to flood Hamas' network of underground tunnels. The devastation in Gaza raises questions about the war's aftermath, and the U.S. accused Netanyahu's government of blocking anything remotely approaching a two-state solution. Biden warned Israel against an endless war, comparing the campaign in Gaza to the U.S. war in Afghanistan. "Don't make the same mistake we made at 9/11," he said. Netanyahu, for his part, rejected a U.S. plan to have the Palestinian Authority, which administers the West Bank, oversee Gaza after the war. Still, the U.S. was one of 10 countries to vote this week against a U.N. General Assembly resolution calling for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire. 153 nations voted in favor and 23 abstained, as U.N. Secretary General Antonio Guterres accused Israel of forcing Gazans to ricochet between ever smaller slivers of the South. What the columnist said: "There's no such thing in war as a tactic with zero risk," said Noah Rothman in National Review. "Pumping water from the Mediterranean into Gaza's tunnels could contaminate Gaza's remaining freshwater supply and worsen its crisis. But the alternative is imperiling Israeli forces as they move room by room through Hamas' deadly rabbit warrens. The way Hamas can spare its fighters from their watery graves and mitigate the environmental risks is to surrender unconditionally to IDF forces and hand over the hostages it seized." Biden's comments were among his most critical of Israel, said Perry Bacon Jr. in the Washington Post. "But actions speak louder than words, and his administration continues to provide military and diplomatic support. It circumvented Congress last week and unilaterally sold Israel over $100 million worth of ammunition. It would be easy and logical to stop selling Israel weapons and join global calls for a ceasefire. Instead, Biden is eroding America's credibility in foreign affairs." "Israel launched this campaign with no plan for what to do in the wake of any victory," said Thomas L. Friedman in the New York Times. "Rebuilding Gaza will be a multi-billion dollar, multi-year endeavor. Israel needs international support, and it won't find any without a legitimate Palestinian partner and a plan for a two-state solution. Yet Netanyahu is appealing to his base by refusing to help nurture a revamped Palestinian Authority. If this continues, Gaza could end up a giant sucking chest wound for Israel." Controversy of the week: anti-Semitism. Are elite universities turning a blind eye to hate? It should have been the easiest softball question in history, said Jeffrey Blahar in National Review, appearing before the House Education Committee last week. University of Pennsylvania President Liz McGill was asked by Representative Elise Stefanik, Republican from New York, whether calls for the genocide of Jews violated her institution's code of conduct. With her face locked in a condescending grimace, McGill conceded that the championing of mass murder would count as harassment only if the speech turns into conduct and that context matters. Harvard's Claudine Gay and Sally Kornbluth of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology echoed McGill's weasel words, with all three presidents offering blandishments about personally abhorring anti-Semitism. Yet they have done almost nothing to combat the actual explosion of anti-Semitism on their campuses following Hamas's October 7th attack on Israel, such as Penn radicals spraying "The Jews are Nazis" on buildings, or a Harvard Law Review editor menacing and shouting shame at Jewish students. Facing a firestorm of criticism from donors, McGill resigned days after the hearing. That delighted Stefanik, said Will Bunch in the Philadelphia Inquirer. One down, two to go, the lawmaker wrote on X, vowing more hearings targeting elite universities. But her campaign isn't driven by a principled stance against anti-Semitism. If it were, Stefanik would have apologized for the 2022 election ads in which she appeared to endorse the racist great replacement theory that mass immigration is a liberal plot, a conspiracy theory that fueled the madman who shot up Pittsburgh's Tree of Life synagogue in 2018. For Stefanik and fellow Trumpist, anti-Semitism is simply a weapon to cripple colleges as incubators of critical thinking that might cause the next generation to question their authority. Hate speech is a scourge, said David Rothkopf in the Daily Beast. But the presidents were right to insist on context. There is no clear answer on what counts as genocide endorsement. Does it include chants to free Palestine from the river to the sea, or calls to flatten Gaza? These are painful debates, and we need scholars who encourage nuance, principle, and context to oversee them. Good luck finding them, said Andrew Sullivan in his Substack newsletter. It's amazing that Gay kept a straight face while praising Harvard's commitment to free expression. Her institution mandates that students attend training sessions to be taught that using the wrong pronouns is abuse. And it allowed evolutionary biologist Carol Hooven to be hounded out for daring to say that sex is binary. But Gay and fellow diversity, equity, and inclusion ideologues see no hypocrisy here. Under their rules, it is fine to malign, abuse, and denigrate oppressors, such as whites, men, and now apparently Jews, but not the oppressed. Switching Jews into the oppressed class will not solve the problem. We need to purge the toxins of critical theory and DEI from campuses. Free speech supporters saw this backlash coming, said Anthony L. Fisher in the Daily Beast. Following the social justice revolutions of 2020, progressives argued that hurtful speech was violence and that problematic people must be punished by authorities and institutions. Now right-wing culture warriors are using those same arguments, insisting progressives be canceled for their problematic tolerance of offensive speech. The lesson is simple. Do not demand fallible authorities to be the arbiters of acceptable discourse, because you will not always be favored by the authorities. It was a good week for various women, upon whom Hunter Biden allegedly lavished some $683,000 from 2016 to 2020. According to his new federal indictment on tax charges. Those expenses comprise a large portion of the $1.6 million that Biden withdrew from ATMs during that period. It was a good week for exoneration. After the crew of the International Space Station found the desiccated husk of the first ever space-grown tomato, which disappeared 8 months ago. The discovery clears the name of U.S. astronaut Frank Rubio, who grew the tomato and was suspected of having eaten it. And it was a good week for living and learning. After a Washington State woman who put a venomous octopus on her face to help a friend win a photo competition was hospitalized with partial facial paralysis. "We're human. We all make mistakes," shrugged Jamie Biseglia, who has recovered. But it was a bad week for optimists. After a new study found their sunny disposition is often accompanied by bad memory, impaired verbal fluency, and poor decision-making skills. Optimism, the study declares, may be a side product of the true driver, low cognitive ability. It's a bad week for the Christmas spirit. After Donald Trump began selling $35 wrapping paper featuring his mugshot photoshopped in a Santa hat, alongside the message, "Never surrender." The mugshot was taken in August when Trump surrendered to authorities in Georgia. Finally, it was a bad week for free-range pork. After New Jersey police recaptured Albert Einswein, a 4-year-old pig who'd escaped from a local farm after a 30-minute chase on foot. "He didn't listen to our commands at all," said Detective Sergeant Bob Jones. Short in other news piece here. Abortion pill case heads to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court agreed this week to hear its first major abortion case since overturning Roe v. Wade last year. The justices will decide on the availability of the abortion pill, mifepristone, used in more than half of U.S. pregnancy terminations. In April, a Trump-appointed district judge in Texas ruled that the Food and Drug Administration had improperly approved the drug 23 years ago. A New Orleans-based appellate panel kept the FDA's original approval in place, but said the agency did not follow proper procedures in 2016 when it broadened access to the drug, enabling telemedicine prescriptions and delivery by mail. Before rules were loosened, mifepristone required 3 in-person visits to the doctor. The Biden administration says the decision wrongfully intruded on federal regulatory authority. The title of the briefing this week is America's Natural Gas Boom. The fossil fuel has replaced coal as the top source of electricity in the U.S. Is that good for the climate? Is natural gas cleaner than coal? It's long been considered the more climate-friendly of the two fossil fuels. That's largely because gas-burning power plants emit about half as much carbon dioxide per unit of energy compared with coal-fired plants. Natural gas, now the dominant fuel in the U.S. electricity sector, has other advantages over coal. It generates fewer toxic airborne pollutants when burned. Extracting the fuel through hydraulic fracturing or fracking, using high-pressurized water, sand, and chemicals to fracture underground rock formations, releasing gas and oil, also has a less destructive impact on land than open-pit coal mines. Those factors have led energy companies, lawmakers, and even some environmentalists to call natural gas a reliable bridge fuel that can reduce emissions amid the transition to renewables. And since 2005, planet warming carbon emissions from U.S. power plants have shrunk by some 40%, as hundreds of coal-fired power plants have been retired and many replaced with gas plants. But a growing body of research is now casting doubt on natural gas as a climate solution. "The fuel is a bridge to nowhere," said Leah Stokes, an expert on environmental politics at the University of California, Santa Barbara. What's the problem with natural gas? When the fuel's entire ground-to-combustion life cycle is considered, natural gas is just as harmful to the climate as coals, researchers argue. Natural gas is almost entirely made up of methane, a potent greenhouse gas that's nearly 90 times more powerful at trapping heat in the atmosphere in the short term than carbon dioxide. And natural gas production is notoriously leaky. The gas is sometimes released at fracking sites for safety purposes, but it also escapes from wells and processing plants and from pipelines that transport it to power plants and homes. A recent study led by researchers at the Rocky Mountain Institute in Colorado found it takes only 0.2% of a gas to leak from the country's gas production and supply system for the fuel to be as big a driver of climate change as coal. Aerial surveys of U.S. oil and gas production sites, the researchers note, have found leak rates ranging from 0.65% to 66.2%. Liquefied natural gas, LNG, the gas takes up 600 times less space in its liquid form and so is easier to export, could have an even bigger climate impact. Why is LNG considered such a risk? Supercooling the gas to minus 259 degrees Fahrenheit, the temperature at which it condenses into a liquid, is an energy-intensive process. LNG is then loaded onto specialized carrier ships, which set sail for Europe and Asia. During long voyages, insulated storage tanks inevitably absorb heat from the outside air, causing some LNG to regasify. The so-called boil-off gas must then be released to maintain the tank's pressure. The most modern LNG ships use that boiled-off methane for fuel. Robert Warren Howarth, a methane expert at Cornell University, estimates that in the best-case scenario, the life cycle greenhouse gas emissions from LNG are 24% higher than those from digging up and burning coal. In the worst case, emissions are 274% higher. Ending the use of LNG must be a priority, said Howarth, but most energy analysts believe the U.S. LNG industry is just at the start of a decades-long boom. What's driving that growth? Energy insecurity. Following Russia's 2022 invasion of Ukraine, the European Union went from importing more than 50% of its gas from Russia to below 20%. The EU offset that loss by ramping up imports of LNG, helping to transform the U.S., which exported almost no LNG a decade ago, into the world's largest supplier of the fuel. More than two dozen new or expanded export terminals are now being constructed or are under consideration in the U.S., and exports of LNG are expected to double over the next 4 years. Activists who oppose this expansion are effectively denying energy security to millions of people, said a spokesman for Venture Global, which is seeking to build a $10 billion LNG export facility in southwestern Louisiana. Does the Biden administration support such projects? It has approved natural gas projects at roughly the same rate as the climate-indifferent Trump administration, including plans this year for a $39 billion gas pipeline and LNG plant in Alaska. The administration is also trying to curb the industry's planet-warming emissions. The Inflation Reduction Act, signed by President Biden last year, allows fines to be levied against companies that emit large quantities of the gas. And under new Environmental Protection Agency rules announced earlier this month, oil and gas firms will be required to monitor and fix methane leaks. Third parties, including environmental groups, will also be allowed to detect and report large methane releases. Will that make a difference? The The EPA estimates that its new rules, likely to be challenged by Republican-led states, could eliminate 58 million tons of methane emissions by 2038, equivalent to the annual carbon emissions of all U.S. coal-fired plants. But technology that will allow for precise methane measurements is still being developed. The planes, drones, ground sensors, and satellites currently in use provide intermittent and limited data, which could make it easier for emitters to file legal challenges against any penalties. Still, the problems are way smaller than the opportunity to finally deal directly with a greenhouse gas, said Deborah Gordon of the Rocky Mountain Institute, especially a very powerful greenhouse gas that has never been on the agenda. Moving into the best columns of the week. First two come from the U.S., starting with, "Yes, this is who we are." This is not who we are. Freaked out liberals and some traditional conservatives have been repeating that reassuring myth since Donald Trump shocked them by narrowly winning the 2016 presidential election, said Mark Leibovich. Trump's narrow victory was a fluke, many insisted, and the country would soon return to some semblance of sanity. But in 2020, after he told Americans to ignore COVID and take quack cures, was impeached for blackmailing Ukraine, and the daily OMG and WTF of it all, Trump received 74 million votes, about 47% of those cast, and barely lost key swing states to Joe Biden. When Trump's incendiary big lie about stolen elections helped incite the violent January 6 assault on the U.S. Capitol, we were told again, this is not who we are. But even after the riot, 147 Republicans in the House and Senate backed the lie by voting not to certify the election. Now, after four criminal indictments, Trump is the likely Republican nominee and has a serious chance of retaking the White House. Like it or not, we includes tens of millions of Americans who see Trump spiral deeper into his moral void and still conclude, yes, that's our guy. The GOP's vulnerability on abortion. Polls show Americans are deeply dissatisfied with the Biden presidency and the direction of the country, said Matthew Continetti. But despite Biden's age and vulnerability, he and the Democrats remain competitive in both national and state elections and keep outperforming the polls when ballots are actually cast. The reason is clear. If the issue is abortion, Democrats win. Consider the recent landslide approval of a referendum codifying abortion rights in conservative Ohio, the re-election of Democratic Governor Andy Beshear in deep red Kentucky, and the Democrats taking both houses of Virginia's legislature. In 2024, independent voters may hold Donald Trump and the GOP House and Senate candidates responsible for his fulfilled promise to appoint Supreme Court justices who would overturn Roe. Ironically, Trump understands that abortion presents a political dilemma for Republicans and has called strict state limits and bans a terrible mistake. But even as he distances himself from pro-life allies, Trump will struggle against the Democratic charge that Republicans intend to ban abortion nationally. That perception and Trump's own deeply flawed character could be critical in closely decided swing states. The 2022 and 2023 elections were a wake-up call, but the GOP is sleeping through it. This column comes from Canada. A country littered with rotting boats. Canada's coasts and riverbanks are gorgeous, or would be if they weren't dotted with abandoned and sinking boats, said Christian Williamson. Waterways from British Columbia to New Brunswick are clogged with decaying vessels whose owners can't be found and so can't be forced to haul them away. Why aren't highways littered with rusting hulks of cars? Because we have strict ownership registries that meticulously connect vehicles to owners. Canada's boat ownership registry, by contrast, is so loosey-goosey that even the hefty new $50,000 fines and possible jail time for abandoning boats have no deterrent effect. All these rotting vessels aren't just unsightly. They leach fiberglass, oils, lubricants, fuels, and other toxins, poisoning the water and with it the food chain. Since 2016, federal and provincial governments have paid to haul off a few hundred of the wrecks, but there are more boats than funding. And coastal communities are now fed up. A new bill before Parliament would tighten up ownership records, assist owners in finding ways to dispose of their dying vessels, and empower First Nations and local groups to clean up their own shorelines. Lawmakers must pass it soon, or our fragile marine environment could be irreparably damaged. And the last word, our feature article, titled this week, The Great Disconnect. Phone screens and the internet had taken over my family's life, said Chris Moody in The Atlantic. To regain control, we went ahead and cut the virtual cord. Before our first child was born last year, my wife and I often deliberated about the kind of parents we wanted to be, and the kind we didn't. We watched families at restaurants sitting in silence, glued to their phones, barely taking their eyes off the screens between bites. We saw children paw at their parents, desperate to interact, only to be handed an iPad to keep quiet. We didn't want to live like that. We vowed to be present with one another, at home and in public. We wanted our children to watch us paying attention to each other and to him. The reality after our son was born was quite different. In those sleep-deprived early days, I found myself resorting to my phone as a refuge from the chaos. I fell into some embarrassing middle-aged dad stereotypes. I developed a bizarre interest in forums about personal finance and vintage hats. I spent up to 4 hours a day looking at my phone while right in front of me was this new, beautiful life, a baby we had dreamed about for years. My wife, Christina, felt abandoned in the isolation of new motherhood and complained of my near-constant phone use. When you look at your phone, she told me, it's as though you disappear. When it comes to having an unhealthy relationship with technology, I'm in good company. Most of us find that smartphones have made our lives better, but we struggle to use them in healthy ways. American adults spend an average of 4.5 hours on their phones each day, the research firm Insider Intelligence reported this summer. Almost all of us keep our smartphones within arm's reach during waking hours, Gallup found, and most of us do so when we sleep. A majority of married couples report that their partner's divided attention has caused strife in their relationship. On a warm Saturday afternoon this past spring, I reached a breaking point. I had been on my phone for hours a day for the past several weeks. I found myself reaching for the phone whenever there was an opportunity or brief pause in parenting responsibilities. Was this what life was going to be like for the next 30 years? Days filled with a series of small interruptions while I scrolled for scraps of trivia and news. While our child napped in the afternoon, I sat brooding on the porch. I told Christina that I wasn't happy with the way we were living and that I didn't know what to do to get back on track. It sounds like we should get rid of the internet, she told me. I knew she was right. For years, we had discussed raising our child in a tech-light home, but we had become so overwhelmed with parenting that this priority had been pushed aside. We had tried half measures before, setting a timer on the Wi-Fi router that shut it off during evening hours, making no phone zones in the house, but these were too easy to get around. To achieve what we truly wanted, a home that served as a sanctuary for meaningful family time without distractions, this was the step we needed to take. When? I asked. Now, she said. As millennials born in the mid-1980s, my wife and I are part of the last generation to have known life before the introduction of widespread home internet access. We straddle both sides of the digital revolution. We remember answering the telephone without knowing who was calling, showing up at a friend's house unannounced, what it was like to be lost and bored. In my 20s, I traveled across Europe, Latin America, and Asia for months without a phone, relying only on guidebooks and advice from strangers. I hitchhiked across the American South with a flip phone. I did a stint on a commercial fishing crew in Alaska, which put me completely off the grid for 5 months without access to a phone or the internet. Christina and I had also gone off the grid together earlier in our marriage. In 2018, we moved into a 72-square-foot tiny house we built into a cargo van where we lived for 2 years, mostly on public lands without Wi-Fi. In the wilderness, cellular data was limited, so we logged on only for essentials when we popped back into civilization. It was on the fringes where we first tasted the joy of a life in which the internet was merely a tool. Without distractions, the days seemed to expand. We learned to harvest time, an idea that came to us in national forests across the U.S. We realized that days undisturbed by digital interruptions made time slow down and improved the quality of our time together. Life was broken down to its most basic elements. Find a place to sleep, cook simple meals to eat, bathe in a river, explore. So yes, we'd had some practice with this before. Surely we could make it work. But we did need a plan. We live in a log cabin beyond the reach of cell towers in North Carolina's rural high country, and up until that point we had relied on Wi-Fi to make phone calls. We might be crazy enough to cut our home off from the internet, but we didn't want to be completely disconnected. We were trying to relive the 90s, sure, but not the 1890s. Opting out of the internet would require us to opt in to a landline, which raised even more questions. If we needed to call a doctor, how would we find the phone number? What if we needed an emergency plumber? Turns out, the Yellow Pages still exist. When the technician from the phone company arrived to put in our landline, I asked, "Do you install many landlines these days?" "Mostly just for old people," he said. I told him we were doing it in hopes of making our lives simpler. He nodded as if to say, "Sure, man, whatever." With a couple of twists of his tools, the room filled with a sound I hadn't heard in ages, a dial tone. That long-forgotten but familiar pitch instantly brought me back to childhood. The anticipation of calling my best friend to ask if he wanted to go outside and play hockey in the street, or the nervous dread in middle school of calling a girl for the first time. I spent our final morning with the internet service on a content binge. I scrolled Twitter. Using a family member's borrowed password, I pulled up one final movie on Netflix, This Is the End. Halfway through the first act, Seth Rogen and James Franco suddenly froze on the screen. The house went quiet. We were officially disconnected. Like any form of withdrawal, the first days offline required adjustment. With nowhere to scroll, I developed a voracious appetite for words. I had downloaded digital versions of magazines to an iPad and loaded my nightstand with books from the library. I devoured them all and started reading anything I could get my hands on. Over time, the racing pace of a mind that had been hooked on content slowed down. I began to read deeply, sometimes for hours, consuming complex works that I would have struggled to focus on before. While reading news articles, I still felt an old tug to share links through social media, but now there was no one to share them with. I was reading purely for reading's sake, sharing an intimate moment with no one but the author. It made reading and thinking a private act without any temptation to be performative in sharing my opinions. At the end of the first week, my phone reported that my screen time had plummeted by 80%. I had reclaimed several hours a day, time that I used to play games with my son, cook elaborate meals, engage in uninterrupted work, and take long walks with my family. Sometimes I just sat and thought, a radical act in our hustle culture. I daydreamed, letting my mind travel where it pleased with no agenda or direction. I realized that it had been years since I'd allowed myself to do, well, nothing. Friends and family have responded with bewilderment and concerned amusement. I could never do that, people often tell us, but I wish I could. When we aren't home, callers seem amused to leave a real voice message on our answering machine. It's fun to listen to younger people leave messages. They are adorably befuddled by what to say. When a friend in her 20s tried to call and got a busy signal, she figured the phone was broken. She'd never heard that sound before. Of course, this has also come with trade-offs. One night, while watching a DVD in our basement, Christina and I saw a dark object flash across the screen. Did a bird get into the house? I stood up to turn on a light and saw another flying object with wide black wings silently swoop past my head. "It's a bat," Christina yelled. She leaped off the couch, onto the ground, and threw me a blanket. "Cover your head." As our eyes adjusted to the light, we watched several bats stream out of our fireplace, flying in circles around our heads. On our bellies, we crawled up the stairs and fled into our bedroom, shutting the door behind us. In normal times, we would have pulled out our phones and started frantically searching for what to do when your house is infested with bats. But we didn't have that option. It was nearly midnight, too late to phone a friend, so we just had to pray that the bats hadn't made it into our bedroom. We covered the baby's crib with a mosquito net and tried to go to sleep. The next morning, Christina called her mother and asked her to search for information while I plunged into the phone book for the number of an exterminator. Over the phone, Christina's mother read us information about how to handle bats and whether we'd need a rabies shot. She was literally reading us the internet. It felt ridiculous. Beyond battling bats in our basement, not having access to the internet also makes working from home a unique challenge. As a journalist, being virtually unreachable has done wonders for my ability to write for long stretches without distraction. But I have to leave the house in search of Wi-Fi to finish some tasks, such as responding to emails from editors, participating in group calls on Zoom, or performing other collaborative work that can only be done online. I spend hours during the workday holed up in my office or the local library, time that otherwise could be spent with a laptop on my couch. My job as a university lecturer requires me to be present in the classroom, so I aim to accomplish as much work as possible on campus. I acknowledge the immense privilege of being able to choose to opt out of a service that people rely on to get by in daily life. I also benefit from work that can be done partially on my own schedule and a job that provides parental leave, which was when we made this decision. But now that we have made this change in our lives, I will grieve if we ever have to return to the life we had before. Our tech light experiment will only become more difficult in the future as more parts of our society require online connection to function. As our child grows, he will no doubt start to wonder why we don't have the same access his friends have. What if he attends a school that requires online homework? Will we be those parents who resist? My own work in the future might not be possible offline. Still, we're not the only ones exploring ways to limit technology's role in our lives. Most people won't or can't go as far as we did, but they can set aside space in their lives uncluttered by devices or their insatiable demand for our attention. Establishing a space beyond tech's reach is a way of declaring independence from our unsettling reliance on technology. It reminds us that we can live and thrive without it, and happily so. Our family certainly has. I like you better without the internet, Christina told me recently. So do I. A version of this story originally appeared in The Atlantic. Here's one of the obituaries. The writer-producer who transformed the sitcom, Norman Lear, 1922 to 2023. In the early 1970s, Norman Lear upended primetime television. At a time when America was riven by social issues from the Vietnam War to the rising feminist movement, Lear wrestled them all to the small screen in hit shows that mixed laughs with unprecedented talk of matters like racism, divorce, and homosexuality. Among them were Maude, about a feisty feminist, and The Jeffersons, featuring an upwardly mobile black couple. Above all, there was All in the Family, which made a household name of Archie Bunker, a combative blue-collar bigot from Queens, played by Carol O'Connor. Bunker browbeat his deferential wife, Edith, Jean Stapleton, sparred with his liberal son-in-law, Meathead, Rob Reiner, and maligned blacks, Jews, hippies, and welfare recipients. On previous sitcoms, the biggest problem any family faced was Mother dented the car and how do you keep Dad from finding out, Lear said in 2012. The message was that we didn't have any problems. Lear was born in New Haven, Connecticut, to a narcissist mother and a salesman father with shades of Archie Bunker, said the Wall Street Journal. After dropping out of college to fly bombers in World War II, he moved to Los Angeles to work in publicity. But comedy writing beckoned, and he began writing jokes for Martha Ray and George Gobel and working on a series of variety shows. He and partner Bud Yorkin had been writing and producing movies like 1967's Divorce American Style when they sold CBS on a U.S. version of a British comedy about a working-class boor. Premiering in January 1971, All in the Family sent a shock through the sleepy world of sitcom, said the New York Times. It wasn't long before 60% of all television sets in America were tuned in each Saturday at 8 p.m. The show became a cottage industry, said Variety, producing a half-dozen spinoffs such as Maude and Good Times, about a struggling family in a Chicago housing project. In the 1974-75 season, five of the top 10 shows were Lear-Yorkin productions. His hot streak ended in the 1980s, but Lear continued creating television into his 90s. The outspoken liberal also promoted progressive causes through an advocacy group, People for the American Way, that he founded in 1981. He often dismissed the notion his shows had changed anything, but we made them talk, he said in 2009. And you know, the funny thing is, People are still talking. And we're over on the Talking Points page. The article referred to in the cover drawing. Economy. Is the U.S. suffering a vibe session? There are two big questions about the economy, said Paul Krugman in the New York Times. Why it's doing so well, and why so many Americans insist it's terrible. A flurry of excellent economic reports has landed in recent weeks. The annual inflation rate, which hit 9% in the wake of the pandemic, now stands at a tamer 3.1%. America's gross domestic product is growing at a world-beating 5.2% rate, and unemployment is hovering near historic lows at 3.7%, with employers adding jobs at a rapid clip. Yet the public seems oblivious to all this good news. More than two-thirds of Americans describe the economy as poor in a recent CNN poll. 55% told the Financial Times that they're worse off since President Biden took office. Unsurprisingly, the president has stopped using his Bidenomics catchphrase in speeches, said Susan B. Glaser in The New Yorker. If the goal of that slogan was to make Americans feel good about the president's economic record, well, they don't feel good. But many households don't just feel worse off, said Bloomberg in an editorial. They are worse off. Consumer prices have climbed about 20% since 2020, and while wages have indeed risen a fraction more, the cost of living for many families is more closely tied to the prices of groceries, utilities, housing, and credit. Groceries are up 25% since 2020. Housing is increasingly unaffordable because of spiking rents, home prices, and mortgage rates. And the share of wages spent on interest payments, including for credit cards and auto loans, is at its highest since just before the 2008 financial crash. Telling ordinary Americans struggling with this reality that the economy is in excellent shape only adds insult to injury. The lingering effects of inflation explain why many Americans are down on the economy, said David Wallace Wells in the New York Times. But there's another big reason for our current vibe session, the pandemic. The chaos of the COVID years scarred a lot of people, shaking their sense of stability. When Americans are asked whether the country or economy is on the right track, they don't treat it as a query about GDP or unemployment, but more like a therapist's query. How are things? And if they sense a negative vibe in the wake of a world historical trauma, is that really a surprise? The question now is whether Biden will be graded harshly for those vibes in 2024. We'll read some of the shorter notes. Many firearms used in crimes, surrendered in buybacks, or replaced during police upgrades end up with gun disposal firms that destroy only the single piece of each weapon that's stamped with a serial number. The rest is resold as a gun kit. One Missouri firm said it has received some 200,000 firearms from 950 police agencies over the past decade. Only 2% of its clients pay to have weapons fully destroyed. 2 years after Congress earmarked $7.5 billion to build tens of thousands of electric vehicle chargers across the country, only one has been installed and fewer than half of the states have begun to take bids from contractors to build the chargers. States in the charger industry blame a complex web of contracting and performance requirements for the delays. Elon Musk has restored the X account of conspiracy theorist Alex Jones. 5 years after the InfoWars host was banned for abusive behavior from the platform formerly known as Twitter. Musk said last year that Jones would stay banned, because of his repeated claim that the Sandy Hook Elementary School massacre was a hoax, explaining, "I have no mercy for anyone who would use the deaths of children for gain, politics, or fame." The number of women crossing state lines to obtain abortions has doubled since the Supreme Court last year overturned the federal right to abortion, according to the pro-abortion rights Guttmacher Institute. About one in five patients who had an abortion in the first 6 months of 2023, some 92,100 women, traveled out of state for their care, compared with 40,600 in the first half of 2020. On the poll watch, 62% of Americans rate the economy as very or fairly bad, compared with 34% who say it's very or fairly good. For 27%, inflation is the most important problem facing the country, while 20% say it's the border. 16% say the biggest problem is the state of democracy, and 12% say it's gun violence. We'll finish the show today with a quote from G.K. Chesterton, quoted in Crisis magazine. He says, "Fallacies do not cease to be fallacies because they become fashions." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you have enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service, and I hope you enjoy your holidays. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call. 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.